on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feedstocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are, in fact, 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence, but it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people died before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip, as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented, and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now at Mehrabad Airport of Tehran. You may want to know where I'm going to take a tour today. Actually, today we are heading to Yazd, and our final destination is Fahraj village. In this village, we will visit the oldest mosque of Iran, the Jame Mosque of Fahraj. Fahraj village is located 22 kilometers southeast of the city of Yazd. This village dates back to pre-Islamic era. This village was once called Farofar. The Jame Mosque of Fahraj, or the Congregational Mosque of Fahraj, is the oldest mosque in Iran and is one of the oldest mosques in the world. This mosque was built in the first half of the first Hijri century. The main building of the Jame Mosque of Fahraj dates back to the Sasanid era, which changed into a mosque after the emergence of Islam in Iran. The Jame Mosque of Fahraj is the type of Shabestani and does not have any iwan, that is, rectangular hall or space, usually vaulted, walled on three sides, with one end entirely open. This mosque has kept its usage and is still used for performing daily prayers. What is interesting about the mosque's architecture is its simplicity. You won't see any extra design and decoration. Inside the mosque, there is no mihrab, dome, inscriptions, tile work, or other crafts usually used in building a mosque. The Jame Mosque of Fahraj primarily consists of an internal courtyard, main Shabistan, winter Shabistan, the entrances, and the minaret. I am now in the beautiful village of Fahraj. This village has an old part that houses the Jame Mosque of Fahraj. The alleys of this village are very pretty. The alley which I'm passing through right now has a ceiling. Since this region is very hot and dry, the alleys are covered to protect the passers-by against the scorching sun. Well, we are getting close to the Jame Mosque of Fahraj. I can see its minaret. I have brought a chador with myself, which I'm going to wear. Since this mosque is still used for worshipping, we should observe the etiquettes and manners of attending a mosque. I am now in the central courtyard of Fahraj Mosque. Honestly, this structure is a very simple and plain building. No tile work, no decorations. Though, the modest architecture has a very strange effect on one's spirit. The combination of lofty art and spirituality. You know, you will be amazed at how this plain building can arouse a mysterious feeling in you. I'm totally affected by it. My words fail me in describing the beauty of this mosque. Adobe bricks in big size and barrel vaults are all the type of architecture which belongs to the Sasanid era. Before I forget, this mosque has two mihrabs. There is also a minaret next to the mosque, which has been added to the mosque later. There is also a winter Shabistan, which archaeologists believe has been added to the mosque later. The atmosphere of the mosque is very spiritual and gives one a very good sense of spirituality. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Now, the gathering of top diplomats from Israel, Egypt, the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, as well as the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Palestinian-occupied territories referred to as the Naqab Desert, has provoked strong reactions from Palestinian resistance groups, calling it a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots and occupation. In this edition, we will be discussing what is behind this move and what it means for Palestinians fighting for their freedom. My guests for tonight's show are Palestinian Solidarity Campaign Mick Napier from Edinburgh and human rights advocate and Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan from Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Mr. Napier. Now, this meeting is being held in the occupied territory of the Naqab Desert. Isn't this another stab in the back of the Palestinians?
It's not secret anymore. It's not furtive anymore. The Saudi regime is still keeping in the shadows its deepening alliance with Israel, but this is now out in the open, and it's clear that these regimes have decided that there's nothing that Israel will do which will cause them to end their diplomatic relations, their normalization. It is absolutely incredible that a regime led by Naftali Bennett, who will be one of the hosts for the event, a man who said famously I've killed many Arabs, and I don't have a problem with that, is now hosting the leaders, the foreign ministers of three of the Arab states in the region. And it's also interesting, by the way, that they're meeting Ben-Gurion's old ranch, I forget what it's called, something Sofer, because Ben-Gurion was very clear that there were no limits to Israeli expansion. He very clearly stated in a biography by an Israeli politician of him that there was no limits to be placed on Israeli expansion except that which could be achieved by military power. So these foreign ministers are meeting to really give a green light to Israel to commit increasing crimes against the Palestinian people. And also, I think, to cause Israel to become stronger, which ultimately will be a threat to not just the Palestinians, for whom it's a deadly threat, but for the whole region.
Exactly, Mr. Napier, that's absolutely correct. And Ms. Wahdan, as Mr. Napier mentioned, the presence of politicians of this caliber will obviously embolden Israel and encourage more atrocities against Palestinians. What is the motive of these Arab leaders who were once considered supporters of their Palestinian brothers and sisters, and how far do you think they would go?
I think this shows that these Arab regimes have reached a bankruptcy, a political bankruptcy, total political bankruptcy. This summit of shame, as we call it, is not going to bring any security for the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. It's not going to bring anything for the Gulf states as well, for the Egyptians and for the Moroccan together. The people of these countries actually are anti-colonialization, anti-normalization with the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. So they couldn't achieve anything after they publicly started normalizing with apartheid Israel. So it seems like Israel is going to be gaining some moral, let's say, achievements. On the ground, there was a big demonstration in the Naqab area on the Land Day. That's the 46th anniversary of Land Day in Palestine, which is going to be celebrated on the 30th of March. It is coinciding with a military operation that was run or executed by a Palestinian from Beersheba, which is Beer Sabah in the Naqab. So all these the resistance and the confrontations by the Palestinians is accelerating as well to defy and to confront the Israeli acceleration of their aggressions against the Palestinians in all of Palestine. The Naqab is in 1948. The people of the Palestinians there have been facing land confiscations since 1950. And the Israelis continue to expropriate more lands from the Palestinians, continue to destroy villages for the Bedouins there, like Al-Arqub, for example. It was destroyed over 200 times, and it was rebuilt again by the Palestinians. So all these measures, harsh measures, aggressive measures against the Palestinians will create resistance, will create confrontation, and this confrontation has been accelerating in the Naqab area in particular, as in all Palestine, but particularly Naqab area, and the Palestinians there has been confronting all these measures day after day. So what we are seeing is all of Palestine is going to be confronting the Israelis on Land Day and afterwards during Ramadan month. So all these accelerating, as Israel has been saying just a while ago, the Israeli army is being put on alert because they are expecting some sort of missile attack against the summit, the shame of the summit of shame in the Naqab area, which means that Palestinians in total are refusing this summit to be taken place on their occupied land, and stabbing Palestinians, continue to stabbing Palestinians since actually the establishment of these monarchies as a functional state in the few decades after the oil. So the United Arab Emirates has been established in 1972. Our connection with the land in Palestine goes back to 10,000 years, and the United Arab Emirates have been established 1972 by the will of the British colonization in the Gulf and in our area. So there is no doubt for us that these countries are going to face, even in their countries, they're going to face confrontation, and they're going to lose the game with the Israelis. The Israelis here to gain more money from the Gulf states, while Ms. they Bachtan. Are going to lose.
I'm sorry, our time is limited, so let's go over the questions faster. Mr. Napier, I would like to ask you this question. The normalization with Israel, what does it mean for the Palestinians who are fighting for freedom, and what options are they left with to realize their goal of liberating their occupied lands?
I think they realize who their friends are and who their enemies are. Look, I think this takes place against a background of a crisis inside Washington. Washington is interested above everything else in confronting China. That's the big foe, and everything else that detracts from that is a problem. America is drawing down its attention, its investments, military and economic and political, in the Middle East. And therefore, the question for the Gulf Emirates, like the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and so on, is who will protect them from their own people? Who will protect them from external enemies? And they have decided that the best substitute for American intense interest in the area is Israel. So they're gravitating towards it because they correctly see Israel as an extension of American power into the region. I don't mean that Zionism is completely loyal to America. Far from it. Zionism is for hire. It's not for sale. But it has been for hire to the Americans for a very long time, and that link remains strong. And therefore, if the states that were previously or up till now have been guaranteed with defense agreements with the USA are to look towards the future, they see that future as moving closer to Israel. Now, of course, there's lots of dirty poker. Morocco is going to be there because in order for Morocco to rubber stamp the dispossession of the Palestinians to give a green light to Israel, Israel and America gave a green light to Morocco to suppress the United Nations endorsed right of the people of Western Sahara to self-determination. This Sudanese government won't be there, but they've also signed a normalization deal with Israel. But that's a problem because there is a very powerful popular movement in Sudan which has prevented the Sudanese government from opening an embassy there so far. So for the Palestinians, they understand deeply and profoundly there's no alternative but resistance. Resistance in all its forms. Because actually the Israelis do not, at the end of the day, offer anything to the Palestinians except doom. Their expulsion, their replacement by Jews from around the world, or if there's not enough Jews from anybody else, as long as they're not Palestinians, and therefore they have to resist. And when they resist, they will find that the peoples of these states, the Egyptian people, the Moroccan people, are their allies, but the Moroccan and the Egyptian governments are, of course, their bitter enemies, tied very closely to America. And they're moving. The summit in the Negev, where if they look out of the window of their very exclusive hotel, as your other guest said, they will be able to see and smell and feel The rage, the ethnic cleansing which is taking place in the Nakab, a clear plan by the Israelis to remove the Palestinian Bedouin, many of whom have been involved in agriculture for a very long time. I mean, do your viewers know that in the Nakab, the Palestinian agriculturalists have faced aircraft, Israeli government aircraft, spraying poison from aircraft onto their crops, and the plan is to drive these people into concentration zones, terrible, poor, miserable, in order to free up most of the land surface for Jewish colonization. That's what these foreign ministers will be in the middle of until Monday, I believe. So the Palestinians have no alternative but to resist. Resist means possible, and they need the support of the masses of people in the Middle East and the masses of people around the world, like the California dockers who refuse to unload Israeli ships. If that spreads, Israel can be defeated ultimately.
Thank you very much. Now, Ms. Watton, do you think that there are any prospects of this summit leading to some kind of conclusion that may affect the political equations of the region?
Well, I think, first of all, the Israelis will not get anything out of this summit. The Israelis are facing existential threat in Palestine as well as in the region. The axis of resistance and the Palestinian resistance from one side are combined together to confront the Israeli expansionist policy. And they feel, the Israelis feel, that this threat is getting closer and closer, and they're losing their battle with the Palestinians as well with the Arab nations around us and in the axis of resistance countries. So they have no future here except two choices, to leave the country here or to live as citizens without, you know, abolishing colonization, abolishing apartheid. This is the only choice that they have. But I think that the leaders of this apartheid regime is pushing even their own people to a confrontation, to a deadly confrontation with the Palestinians. And eventually, as we witnessed last May, during the sword operation, that the population, their population, the Jewish population, were afraid to stay in their homes. And they, people of Lod, for example, in 1948, were trying to escape their city and go to other safer places. So what we are seeing very gradual and steadily, that the Israelis are retreating, although they are disclosing their plans to connect the West Bank to what they call Israel. But on the ground, they're facing more and more resistance from the people. An hour ago, as it was aired just minutes ago, there was an operation south of Haifa in 1948, where four policemen were shot by Palestinians. And four of them are having serious wounds. So what we are seeing on the ground in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in Jerusalem, include also in 1948, more and more resistance to the Israeli measurements, harsh measurements, and aggressive measurements against the Palestinians. They think that they can suppress 7 million people in historic Palestine. And what they see is more and more resistance, more and more confrontations. So what I see in the near future, that the Palestinians will win this war and the Israelis will retreat. We'll win this war against the apartheid Israel.
Well, thanks, Ms. Watan. Mr. Napier, the summit has been called at a time when the parties to the JCPOA are very close to reviving the deal. Do you think this summit can in any way jeopardize that?
You know, it's almost impossible to call. It looks like they can't. It looks like Blinken is going there to tell his client states, the Arab foreign ministers, that this deal will go forward. And he's using all sorts of forms of words, threats against Iran, in order to tell them that there's no alternative but the acceptance of the JCPOA. So I'm not an expert in that field, but everything seems to point in that direction. And if I could just add a few things. These Arab foreign ministers are meeting there with Blinken, with the Israeli government leaders, who are gloating at this. The very fact of this meeting is a stick for them to beat the Palestinians with, to say to the Palestinians, look, we have relations with these governments. You are alone. You're isolated. You ultimately will face defeat. But as our other guest has said, that's not the case. The people who win in an anti-colonial struggle like this are not those who have massive violence and massive technology and an overwhelming military edge. That was the case in Algeria. The French won the military confrontation in Algeria. It was popular revolt which drove them out. And I think this will be the case again. In case after case, it's not the people with the great violence, that's the Israelis who win, hands down. It's the people who can accept the suffering, the pain, the agony that the Palestinians are going through and still continue to resist. And these foreign ministers cannot give Israel the legitimacy which it craves. It craves legitimacy. It's born in blood and ethnic cleansing, and it craves acceptance by the world. But the only people who can give Israel legitimacy are the Palestinians, and they will not do so. Our other guest has shown eloquently that resistance is rising. If you look back at last May, when there were moves against Al-Aqsa Mosque, fascist gangs in Israel were attacking Palestinians, rockets from Gaza challenged the Israelis in a way that they'd never expected, and it created a degree of unity among the Palestinian people I hadn't seen for a very long time. So yes, I agree with your other guest. Israel can be defeated. It depends on Palestinian resistance and other actors in the region and beyond coming to their aid.
Mr. Napier, that was a great example, Algeria right there. You pointed that out. And Ms. Watan, the Abraham Accords are a rare Trump-era policy that was fully embraced by Biden's team. What does this mean for the Palestinian resistance group? And we have only 1 minute left.
Yeah, well, the U.S. administration's policy towards Palestinians and in other areas of the world, it hasn't changed. With Biden, with Trump, with Bush, with Obama, it's the same policy. You know, who runs the USA foreign policy is the industrial complex, is the financial companies, and it's not the people who elect, it's not the parties, it's not the Democrats or the Republicans, it's not the people who elect their representative to make these foreign policy. There is the deep state which puts forward this foreign policy. And it doesn't change whether it's Abraham agreement was signed during Trump. Biden has blessed it and went forward with it. The USA embassy in Jerusalem is there to stay. The Biden administration didn't move it back to Tel Aviv. So their policy is just the same. Who decides is mainly the military complex in the USA. And we're going to see the same treatment by the USA. Blinken is here to order
the Palestinian
Authority to go ahead with their policies here. As I said before, the people on the ground, the people who are confronting the Israeli occupation.
I'm sorry, we're running out of time. So I saw Mr. Napier also nodding, agreeing with Ms. Amal Wahdan, a human rights advocate and Palestinian activist who joined us from Ramallah, and of course from the Scottish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts on this edition of The Spotlight. And thanks for following us.
In the limelight.
The haphazard evacuation of tens of thousands of people from Afghanistan last year, as U.S. troops pulled out of the country, left little time to prepare ORR facilities, which are accustomed to housing Central American children and teens. The COVID-19 pandemic created additional complications. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Melissa Sanchez and Anna Clark, writers. This article is published under the heading, Nearly 200 Children Who Fled Afghanistan Without Family Are Stuck in U.S. Custody. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Months after the fall of Kabul, shelters in the U.S. caring for children evacuated without their parents are experiencing unprecedented violence, while workers at the facilities have struggled to respond to the young Afghans' trauma. Some children have run away, punched employees, and stopped eating. Others have tried to kill themselves. At one shelter, ProPublica has learned some children reported being hurt by employees and sexually abused by others. At least three shelters in Michigan and Illinois have shut down or paused operations after taking in large groups of Afghan children, prompting federal officials to transfer them from one facility to another, further upending their lives. This is not acceptable, said Nahid Samadi Bahram, U.S. Country Director for Nonprofit Women for Afghan Women, which provides mentors to children in custody in New York. These children left their homes with a dream to be stable, to be happy, to be safe. If we cannot offer that here in the U.S., that is the big failure. ProPublica reported in October on serious problems at Chicago shelter that took in dozens of young Afghans. Since then, the troubles have been found in U.S. shelter system that are more widespread. This account is based on law enforcement records, internal documents, and interviews with nearly 2,000 people who have worked with or have talked with the children in facilities across the country, including shelter administrators and employees, as well as interpreters, attorneys, and volunteers. Advocates for the children acknowledge that the Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, the federal agency responsible for overseeing the nation's shelters for unaccompanied immigrant minors, is navigating an exceptional challenge. The haphazard evacuation of tens of thousands of people from Afghanistan last year, as U.S. troops pulled out of the country, left little time to prepare ORR facilities, which are accustomed to housing Central American children and teens. The COVID-19 pandemic created additional complications. In all, some 1,400 unaccompanied Afghan minors were brought to the U.S. last year and placed in ORR custody. Of those, more than 1,200 have gone to live with sponsors, typically relatives or family friends. Nearly all the remaining 190 are teenage boys with nobody there who can take them with. As of March 8, more than 80 Afghan children had been in ORR custody for at least 5 months, according to government data analyzed by the National Center for Youth Law. In a system that normally houses children for about a month, the young Afghans have been waiting in what seems like never-ending detention. It's unclear how or when children will be reunited with their families. The U.S. State Department is working to obtain travel documents for parents who remain in Afghanistan, a spokesperson said, but coordinating departures from Kabul has proven challenging. The ORR said it has placed 56 of the 190 children in its custody into long-term or transitional foster care as of this week and is recruiting more families to take them in. The ORR official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the agency is doing its best to support the Afghan children by providing interpreters, mental health services, additional staffing, and in recent months, Afghan-American mentors. But those efforts won't change the reality for a child that their parent is hiding from Taliban or that their family has died or that they are grappling with some really terrible things that nobody should have to grapple with. I do struggle to know what else we could do doing that we've already not trying to do. And the ORR may soon face another challenge. With the Biden administration's announcement that the U.S. will accept 100,000 Ukrainians fleeing war, people who work in the system are bracing for the children who may arrive without their parents. On a cold and cloudy evening in early January, 19 boys were shuttled in vans to a shelter run by the nonprofit Samaritas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Employees at the shelter had heard that they might receive Afghan children, but thought they would have 2 or 3 weeks to prepare for their arrival. Instead, they had 24 hours notice, according to one worker. A federal emergency intake site that housed dozens of Afghan children almost 85 miles away in Michigan had abruptly shut down, scattering children to facilities across the country, including Samaritas. The shelter was not ready. One Samaritas employee said everything from the food to the reading material to the grievance procedures and rules, everything that we have was set up for Central American kids, and we are not ready. On a given day, some 10,000 or so children and teens are in ORR custody around the country, the vast majority of them from Central America. Facilities that receive them tend to have employees who know their language and culture. Workers often speak Spanish or are Latin American immigrants or children of immigrants. They understand what motivates Central American teens to immigrate each year, pursuing a better education, fleeing gang violence, and earning dollars to support families. The children too often know what to expect because they've heard stories from friends and relatives who immigrated before them. They know it will be about 30 days in ORR's custody before they're sent to live with a sponsor. The Afghan kids were a completely different story, said a former worker at a Pittsburgh shelter run by the nonprofit Holy Family Institute. I felt so sorry for them. They have been there 3-4 months and they still did not know if they would ever see their families again. The pivot to housing Afghan children left shelters flat-footed. many needed prayer rocks, halal meat, and connections to local Muslims who could lead Friday prayers. Even with interpreters who spoke Pashto or Dari, communication between children and employees was very difficult, leading to misunderstandings and mistrust. In the hours before the Afghan children arrived in Grand Rapids, the Samaritas worker said staff members were scrambling, "Okay, like, what language do you like to speak?" It was a culture shock for them. It was a culture shock for us. Samaritas Chief Operations Officer Kevin Van Den Bosch said, "There were many unexpected complications, but we looked at the challenge. If not us, who is going to do it?" Employees at several shelters described the trauma among the youth as more severe than anything they had seen. Children are desperate to call home to check on their parents and other relatives, some of whom worked for the U.S. government or for contractors and are now potential targets. Some feel guilty for being in the U.S., while their families fear for their lives in Afghanistan. After the Afghan children arrived in Samaritas Grand Rapids, police responded nearly every other day to calls for incidents like missing persons, suicide threats, fights, and assaults. The police reports were unavailable, but internal shelter records document many of those incidents. One boy put a rope around his neck, saying, acting like he wanted to hang himself. Another day, a boy tried to suffocate another child with a plastic bag. A few days later, a worker found the boy scratching his forearm. He told her that when his body is in pain, it prevents his head from thinking about his problems. Meanwhile, Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the state's Children Protective Services, is investigating allegations related to Samaritas, though it's not clear what the allegations involve. Department spokesperson Bob Witten said the agency was prohibited by law from disclosing details. Samaritas officials said that while the nonprofit could not provide information about the allegations, the agency follows robust safety protocols to protect the youth in its care. That includes background checks, cameras at the facility, and safety plans for children at risk of self-harm. Advocates said the struggles of some of the Afghan children should have been anticipated. Saman Hamidi Azar, who visits children in ORR facilities as a volunteer with Afghan Refugee Relief, a community organization in California, said even children who have no prior traumatic experiences would begin to show signs of distress at this point, being in shelter care for this long. There is nowhere to pinpoint blame except for the manner in which Afghanistan is evacuated way too fast. No one was prepared on the ground. No one could have expected what happened.